Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start out this portion of the program with a look at the crisis surrounding amphibians, not only in Wisconsin, really, but worldwide. A couple of guests to talk with us about it. Aaron O'Brien is Wetland Policy and Conservation Specialist with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, located in Madison. And Aaron, it's nice to have you back. It's been a while.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to be here.
And Kevin Zippel, with us by phone, is an amphibian ecologist and conservationist and program director for the Amphibian ARC, formerly the World Conservation Union's Conservation Breeding Specialist Group. And Kevin Zippel, you there?
I'm here. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. Thanks a lot for being with us today. Are we really in a crisis with amphibians? Kevin Zippel, I'll turn to you first.
Yes. In fact, what we're facing now, we are calling the next mass extinction event that the Earth has been through in its history. Really, it's somewhere between a third and a half of all amphibians currently threatened with extinction. And the planet really hasn't seen anything like this since the disappearance of the dinosaurs, which is something that the amphibians survived. So it's clearly the greatest species conservation challenge in the history of humanity.
Has this been something that's come on fairly quickly? Has it been evolving over time?
I think it's been happening over time, but certainly it's only been recently that we realized the magnitude of the problem, that, you know, clearly a third of all the amphibian species are threatened with extinction. Another quarter are so exceedingly rare, we don't even know what their status is in the wild. Well over 100 species have gone extinct in just the past few decades. Really now we're just starting to be aware of how profound and widespread the problem really is.
Yeah. Aaron O'Brien, what about some of the reasons for this? I assume some of it relates to habitat, but talk a little about that.
Well, and of course I can speak to the Wisconsin situation, and I defer to Kevin on global amphibian declines, but you know, the research shows that there's a lot of different causes, but habitat loss and habitat fragmentation are two that are playing a significant contributing factor to amphibian declines in Wisconsin, because if they don't have a place to breed or a place to eat, they don't survive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I assume this is going to, and in fact, I know this is going to be something that's covered at the Wisconsin Wetlands Association annual conference. And maybe you could speak a little bit about that. And I know Kevin's going to be the speaker there.
Yeah, that's right. Kevin will be the banquet speaker for this two-day event. So our conference this is our 13th year that we've had this event. And every year we have a different theme. And this year's theme is Wetlands in the 21st Century, Changing Climates and Altered Landscapes. Oh, I actually got that backward, Altered Landscapes and Changing Climates. And so we're talking just about these questions. What are the challenges we've been facing and will face in the next decade and or decades related to wetland habitats and all of the problems that are created when we have a highly human-influenced landscape?
Yeah. I want to join in, have people join in with us, and haven't given the number yet, so let me do that right now. If you'd like to join in, have a question about this as we talk about this conservation, amphibian conservation crisis, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Kevin, I don't know if you probably have been asked something like this, but there might be people who say, well, what's the difference if we lose some frogs or some newts or some salamanders?
Well, there are lots of people like that, and part of my job is changing their attitude. Because really, until people appreciate the fact that amphibians are important, we're kind of talking to deaf ears. People must first change their value system and have a sense of appreciation for amphibians, or no one's going to change their behavior and work to protect them. And usually when I'm trying to convey to people how important amphibians are, I talk about a number of the roles that they play, including the really pivotal role as keystone species in our environment, keeping our environments intact. And my favorite analogy there is pulling rivets from an airplane wing. And I'm stealing this from Paul and Air, like at Stanford University. But
yeah.
it's a great analogy. When we're pulling species out of an ecosystem and we don't really understand what the ramifications are going to be, it's the same as pulling rivets out of an airplane wing. You can take out one here, one there, and you're not really going to affect the functional integrity of the system. But eventually you're going to pull out one that is so important, or collectively you'll have pulled out so many, that the whole system's going to come crashing down. And that's the same for an airplane as it is for an ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, we have callers online to visit with you. Alan in New Auburn is online, so let's go to Alan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'll try to be very brief. Excuse me. We live on a small lake here up in the west central area of Wisconsin, and we had, past tense, a really wonderful population of bullfrogs, and it was just, I mean, they were just. We just loved listening to them in the evenings, and we could see them, and we'd look out of the binoculars, and we just loved having them here. There were, I don't know how many there were, but there were a lot of them out here in this small bay. One evening, two summers ago, a group of young men came through at night. I didn't know what they were doing because I'd never seen this before, but they had their flashlights. Well, I found out very quickly that they were hunting the bullfrogs. And so I went down to the shore because they were walking right along our shore, and I said, well, would you make sure that you don't, you know, don't be pigs about it. You know, I realize there's not a law against this. At least I assume there was, and I didn't really know at the time. Oh, don't worry. We won't take them all. Well, the next morning, I could hardly bear it. There was one bullfrog making its call, and that was it for the rest of the summer. They decimated the bullfrog population, and they never came back last year either. I thought, well, maybe they'll come back. Well, they never came back. I don't know. Maybe they will. I don't know anything about the cycles of bullfrogs. I do know that what they did, there is, I went to the state fish and game booklet, and it said that there really is no limit on how many bullfrogs they can take, which seems to me, in the face of what you're saying and what I've been hearing over the last few years, it seems kind of strange that we would be allowing something like that to take place. Maybe you can fill me in, and maybe I'm wrong about this.
Okay, well, we can get maybe from both people, but Aaron O'Brien, is that are the regulations stated as Alan stated them?
Well, there are some regulations, and this isn't completely my area of expertise, but I believe that that there are licenses and permits that are required for the collection, harvesting, and sale of amphibian species. I don't think that the bullfrogs are ones that are very stringently protected. But I think in a case like that, one thing I would recommend to a landowner would be to confirm that the folks that are doing the collecting actually have a license, and if they suspect that they don't have a license, to contact a conservation warden to check it out. And a lot of this information about these regulations is included in this book, Amphibians of Wisconsin, that's put out by the Wisconsin Bureau of Endangered Resources. And that's a good place to go to understand what the laws do and don't allow.
A comment from you, Kevin?
Yeah, I'm surprised that the collectors would be so efficient that they could have decimated the population like that. But fortunately, we have two things going for us. Bullfrogs are incredibly fecund. All it takes is one pair, and the female can lay 50,000 eggs in a single sitting. So they could very quickly repopulate if you get a pair back in there. And the other thing is bullfrogs, on a global perspective, are doing just fine. It's a shame when they're extirpated from local populations like that, but they have been artificially transported all over the world and introduced into places like Japan and Italy and places where they're really not supposed to be. So they're not going to disappear at the global level anytime soon.
Interesting.
Oh, it was pretty strange, though. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Alan, for calling. Appreciate it. We'll take some more calls. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Patty in Black Creek is next. Patty, hi to you.
I'm wonderful. Excellent topic. I really have to commend you on this. We live out in the country north of Black Creek, and we love watching the land go back to whence it came, to the wetlands. We're really efficient at protecting it and making sure our amphibian friends have a nice habitat. We noticed 12 years ago, when we first lived here, the toads would come out at night all over, and they were marvelous to watch. Big ones and little ones and, you know, all over. You had to watch where you stepped out in the backyard. They would come out from the field. Now, about the last 3 years, they're gone. And it scares us because we're like, okay, guys, this isn't just 1 year. This is going on now past 3 years we might see one or two totes at night on a summer night, not like we used to. And we also noticed the bullfrogs, though, are making more and more noises back there, which is really good because now we're hearing our bullfrogs, you know, more. But the toads are gone. And I want to know, does this have anything to do with the bullfrogs, you know, becoming more and more? We can hear more and more of them just going off at night, but not, we don't see the toads.
Well, Kevin, you want to take a stab at that? You know, you're not a Wisconsin guy, but what are your thoughts?
Well, bullfrogs are highly carnivorous, but fortunately, toads are poisonous at all stages of their life, from the egg through the adult. So I don't think it's a case that the bullfrogs are eating them. They certainly might be out-competing them, but maybe the toads are being perturbed by some other factor. If there's suitable habitat there, certainly they are susceptible to pollution in the environment. If it's an agricultural area where there's fertilizers or herbicides or other pesticides, even urban areas, backyards, depends on what kind of chemicals people are using, but toads are very sensitive to those things.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Patty, for calling. Appreciate it. Joe in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Larry, how are you doing?
Great, thanks for calling.
Great topic. I have a small cabin up north, and when I talk to the old-timers, they say that there used to be tons of frogs and everything. I'm wondering, is there anything we can do managing our frontage to promote frogs?
All right.
I could take a crack at that
one. Okay, Aaron.
Well, of course, habitat is everything, and the thing that people sometimes forget about amphibians is that they're semi-aquatic species, and so portions of their life cycle are dependent upon the water, in your case, maybe the shoreline. But then they also spend a lot of, or many species, not all, spend a lot of their time in the upland areas. And so in the case of shoreline habitat, of course, natural habitat, grassy habitat, is going to be more suitable for these species than, say, riprap, which is, is what we see along some of our shorelines. But also keeping in mind that, that some species need a place to go and connectivity into some kind of natural habitat in the surrounding area, the buffer area. And this can require a lot of area. You know, there's research that shows it's not just 10 or 15 or 20 feet. It can be a mile or a kilometer or several hundred meters. So paying attention to both the you know, the shoreline and the wetland habitat as well as the upland habitat.
I got one more question with lake levels. How dependent are populations on lake levels? Ours is low, been low for about 2 years.
Yeah.
Gosh, I just don't know. I mean, as long as there's shoreland habitat, you know, the habitat, the vegetation will move with the changes in the lake level. So I would think they would be resilient to that, but
yeah, I would think so. Kevin, a comment from you?
Yeah, I think so. As long as the vegetation is moving and there's still suitable margin for them, most species will adapt.
And I would also say that lake quality would have a role to play too. So if it's a natural cycle and the lake levels are declining, but the chemistry of the lake is in good shape and it's not overly polluted, you know, you should be okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks very much for calling. Talking about amphibians today with our two guests, Aaron O'Brien, Wetland Policy and Conservation Specialist with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, and Kevin Zippel, Amphibian Ecologist and Conservation and Program Director for Amphibian ARC. And he will be the banquet speaker at the upcoming Wisconsin Wetlands Association 13th Annual Conference. And you'll be able to come and visit and hear him speak, as a matter of fact. We'll find out some more about that as we move along here. Larry Mueller with Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at amphibians today with our two guests, Aaron O'Brien of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and Kevin Zippel of Amphibian ARC. Really pleased to have them along today. You can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And I forgot to mention, you can also email us at talk@WPR.org. And Robin in Racine is next. So let's go to Robin. Hi, Robin.
Good morning. Thank you, three, for covering this important topic.
Sure.
I'm seeing three different things happening. One is the development and filling of landfills to areas extremely in Wisconsin, but throughout the United States. In addition to that, we have all the chemicals from fertilizers to herbicides to you name it being put down by the agricultural industry, all of the homeowners and businesses that spray everything these days.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I studied last year is the ozone depletion is making the sun more intense, which is creating a negative effect on the eggs while they're hatching. All the eggs on the top are burning out, and the ones on the bottom are the only ones that are surviving these days. So we've got quite a few different whammies happening to these poor guys.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, Robin, let's get a comment from let's go to Kevin. Kevin, hi. Will you comment from you on that?
Yeah, there are so many threats that are facing amphibians right now, each one of them serious in and of themselves. But, you know, together they're just working in synergy, creating what we call this a perfect storm of extinction. And amphibians are in big trouble. That's why we're talking about them today.
Yeah. What about that point that Robin brought up about ozone depletion? Is that something that's on your radar screen?
It is, certainly. And I would say that the final word is not out on that. There have been studies that show that certainly ultraviolet light can affect eggs and developing embryos, but to what extent is not clear. Some studies have shown that for those eggs that are even just a centimeter below the surface, the water is effective at filtering out ultraviolet light, just like you can't get a sunburn through a pane of glass. That thin layer of water protects the eggs. So it can have an effect. To what effect it does in nature, I think, has yet to be clearly demonstrated.
Yeah. Thanks, Robin, for calling. Appreciate it. And William in Presque Isle, it's your turn. Hi, William.
How you doing, gentlemen?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Relative to your comment on the toads being poisonous, I mean, I'm well aware of that. I live in a very rural area and got quite a bit of land here with a lot of wetlands on it, and I've observed amphibians for 30-some years up here. We used to have a lot of toads. That population has become severely depressed. I think it's largely because we also have a garter snake population. Part of the foundation is they overwinter in it. And I've had more than one occasion to watch them predate the small toads. So, you know, there's nothing mysterious about that. It's just, you know, part of the food chain.
Yeah, nature at work. Kevin, comment?
Yep, garter snakes have definitely evolved the ability to override some amphibian poisons. But I think there must be something more at play, because if it were just the garter snakes, most predator-prey relationships usually work in some sort of balance. If there's a good year for the snakes, it'll be followed by a bad year for them and a good year for the toads. And there must be something else going on if the toads are disappearing year after year. It can't just be the garter snakes, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, probably not. Thanks, William, for calling. Appreciate it. You know, I should have asked you both a little bit more about your organizations. And before we go back to the phones, let me do that. Aaron, maybe you could talk a little about the Wisconsin Wetlands Association.
Thank you. I'd be happy to. We are a statewide nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to the protection, restoration, and enjoyment of Wisconsin's wetlands. And we accomplish that mission through science-based education and advocacy. And in fact, we're the only statewide organization of our type in the nation. There are many other organizations that work on wetland issues in D.C. and as part of their missions, but we're the only wetland-specific, wetland-focused organization.
Hmm. And you have a website, too, for people.
We do. Our website is wisconsinwetlands.org, and you can find lots of information on there, including information about protecting wetlands and restoring wetlands, and, of course, everything you need to know and more about the conference that's coming up next week on January 31st and February 1st, including the banquet talk that Kevin Zippel's going to give that's open to the public.
And it's in Oconomowoc.
In Oconomowoc at the Olympia Resort and Conference Center, yes.
And, Kevin, Amphibian Ark, what about it?
Well, you can think of the Amphibian Ark as an umbrella that we have erected over the global zoo community. Zoos and related organizations like aquariums, botanical gardens, natural history museums, and such have been doing great things with amphibian conservation programs for years. But what we're trying to do now is get everybody organized, coordinated, working together as efficiently as possible to raise that level of activity by about a factor of 10 so that we can save as many species as possible that are otherwise going to go extinct in the wild.
And do you have a website?
Amphibianark.org.
Amphibianark.org. All right. Clyde in Cedarburg, it's your turn next. Thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for taking my my call. And,
sure.
Hello to Aaron and to Kevin. Thank you for helping and answering these questions. I have two questions. One is about freeze-out conditions. If a water level on a pond drops several feet, what time of year is a devastating or real bad time for critters that are hibernating in the mud near shore? Or in other words, what's the, you know, if it happens in the fall, is that a better time for it to happen than in the middle of the winter or in early in winter? And the second question is about utility corridors, such as high tension power easements, power line easements. They are basically maintained. They're fairly wide, and they're long, continuous corridors that are seem to be basically maintained strictly for preventing damage to the or problems for the electrical transmission. But they are not maintained for the consequences of that easement. They're not maintained to protect species or to protect the environmental conditions below them, and they often introduce or cause species to invade, especially vegetative species, to invade and take over areas that previously were vegetation and become invasive and noxious species. But there doesn't seem to be any requirement for the power line companies to maintain their easements to mitigate those and prevent those kind of impacts.
Well, let's get a comment. Kevin, first, you want to take a crack at maybe the receding water levels would be a good place to start.
Yeah, certainly some amphibians do spend the colder months underwater and some are underground. And for those that are underwater, I think a change in the water level during the time that they're in there, anything from late fall to early spring, is probably going to have a detrimental effect, especially if they're in the shallower areas or if the entire body of water is relatively shallow. If they're in the deeper waters, they should be fine, but anybody near the edge would be in trouble if the water level was lower during the colder months.
And then the business of power line easements, Aaron, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, the caller raises an important and interesting point, which is that sometimes when we think about wetland conservation, we think about out-and-out fill, so wetland loss to development through, you know, roads or home building. But habitat degradation is also a very important issue and concern. And when you look at linear energy projects like utility lines or pipelines is a really big one. I'm sure lots of your callers have seen the pipelines that are going in from Superior to Washington County right now. We see degradation in the habitat, and yes, when you have that kind of disturbance, either regular mowing or actual trenching through a linear corridor, it can change the habitat values. It can create conditions that are conducive to invasive species, particularly plants, coming in. And we're certainly working with both the DNR and the energy companies to try to improve the restoration and management conditions along those easements to make sure that they are providing suitable habitat, particularly in the wetland areas.
Mm. Thanks, Claude.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
With regard to that, what resources are available? Is there any advice or resources available for people who are faced with those easement that are going in at the current time, rather than like waiting for things to slowly be like worked out?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot depends on what the regulated entity has been required to do or committed to do in their permit. And so, you know, a word of advice to anybody that has one of these projects going through their lands is to become familiar with what the permit conditions are and then to monitor the activity on your own land and to report any concerns you have if the construction best management practices don't appear to be followed properly or if the restoration work was incomplete and or unsuccessful. Because, you know, there are conditions and provisions that will require these companies to come back and make good on their promises to not degrade the landscape in the act of putting in their projects.
Okay. Thanks, Clyde, for calling. Appreciate it. Priscilla in West Bend, it's your turn. Hi, Priscilla.
Well, hello. Thank you so much for this program.
Sure.
I have a cottage up between Mercer and Hurley, which is way up there. And have observed several things. The first thing is between the last, 3 years ago, we have observed frogs that have had badly deformed legs or bodies. And nothing has changed along the lake at all, no major construction. but we were wondering why that is happening. Then this past fall, I believe it was, late in the fall, I observed hundreds of large pollywogs. They were about 4 to 5 inches long and had very, very fat bodies and were along the shore. I could sit on top of the dock and watch these just swarming very, very close to the shore in the sunshine. I'd never, ever seen this before, and I was wondering why so late in the season, or is that normal?
When was it again?
I thought it was late fall.
Late fall.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's turn to Kevin for that. How about the deformed frogs first, Kevin?
Well, I would have to wonder if that body of water were suffering from eutrophication or a buildup of nutrients. We see that a lot with the nutrients leading to a bloom of algae, which leads to a boom in the population of snails, and the snails carry a parasitic fluke that gets into the developing limb buds of tadpoles and causes those malformations. So that would be my first question. Back to you.
Oh, okay.
And then the pollywogs?
And the pollywogs?
Anything of that size in that region would have to be a bullfrog. And mm-hmm. what you saw was actually a pretty cool thing. They were doing behavioral thermal regulation, coming up into the shallow water during the warm part of the day because the water there is warmer, mm-hmm. and raising their body temperature to help speed their development and help with their digestion. And in colder parts of the world, bullfrogs can take a number of years to actually go through the process of metamorphosis. They'll overgo the winter in the tadpole form.
That's interesting.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for calling, Priscilla.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. And Kevin in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I need a little clarification. I think I heard the speaker say that even though this is a bullfrog question, bullfrogs are decreasing in population around this area, we shouldn't be that concerned about the overall health because they've been transported to other areas in the world. I believe he said Europe or someplace where they're thriving. Was that correct?
That's correct. They have been moved all over the world where they are established and doing well, but I don't think that means we have to forget about them back at home in their native range. And, in fact, I would be concerned that they're disappearing and trying to do everything I can to keep them going, whether it's habitat protection, restoration, just to keep them in the ecosystem where they are naturally found.
I agree totally. My question was the transportation around the world. Wouldn't that make the bullfrog then an exotic species in the around the world, and they're thriving because they're elbowing out the indigenous species, and maybe people in those other areas are thinking of bullfrogs like we think of Asian carp, zebra mussels, purple loosestrife, exotics that have been transported here.
Yeah.
You are exactly right.
Yep. You're exactly right.
Gold star.
A gold star for that. And so it's not something that you've been supporting, Kevin.
Not so much. I understand the origin. People are interested in having a ready source of protein, the big meaty legs of the bullfrog. But I think in most cases you can find a native species of frog that is probably almost as large and with a little bit of homework probably just as easy to breed. And I would much prefer that people work with native species rather than moving the bullfrogs and the diseases that they carry.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin, for calling, bringing that up. Ben and Mequon, your turn. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I'd just like to comment on my experiences where I live.
Sure.
I've got two large ponds on my property with a lot of frogs in them. And my problem is a neighboring dairy farmer that spreads manure all year long, and I get a lot of runoff. I've complained to the DNR on this. There's been new legislation on manure spreading in terms of runoff. But the problem is the way the laws are written, the runoff is only an enforceable matter when it's infecting waters of the state, not waters on private property. I've had frog and fish kill-offs when the spring thaw comes. The manure runoff is so concentrated that it literally kills all of the frogs off, and I see them laying in the shallows in the spring. Once the ice is off, within a few days, the seagulls come in and eat them all off. But as I say, the laws have to be more strict on runoff matters. Mm-hmm. The neighboring farmer here spreads manure all year long, every single day of the year, and it is a problem.
All right. Well, let's go to Aaron for that. Aaron O'Brien?
Yeah, I guess I have a few comments. You know, one is the comment about the state waters versus waters on private property. And, you know, the good news is that all of the waters in the state of Wisconsin are considered publicly owned, at least if they're naturally occurring waters. Now, if it's an artificial pond, that may be a different story, but it's under Wisconsin's public trust doctrine. The waters of the state belong to the people of the state, and all of our environmental regulations should apply across the board. Now, the challenges of polluted runoff into, you know, waters and wetlands, rivers, lakes, streams, et cetera, is a major concern. I believe there are regulations on time of year that manure can be spread. I think there are restrictions on winter, you know, spreading under frozen conditions, and that's because when a thaw comes, that creates a runoff event. But then the other thing is, of course, there's always there's a big PIP push, and there's much more regulation and cooperation and collaboration needed in the area of buffers for rivers, lakes, and streams to make sure that when we do have rains and runoff, that there is some protection so that what's coming off the farm fields isn't running directly into those waters.
Yeah. So there may be some, what would a guy like Ben do in that situation? Look into his local municipality for what the rules are on this?
Well, they'd be state rules, and so it would be the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources that could help answer his questions. If you want to get into the statutes, it's NR 151 are the runoff management rules for the state. But I would just call your local DNR office and ask to talk to someone about, you know, say you have some concerns about the runoff coming from your neighbor's field and see if there is any violation of current law.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Ben, for calling. Good luck to you. Ralph in Lake Forest, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Ralph.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning to you all, Aaron and Kevin, as well as you, Larry. What I'm calling about is a situation at the tip of Door County. And, Aaron, you would be very familiar with this. We have crossing our property a pond which is about 850 feet in length and about 250 feet wide and probably ranges to around 4 feet deep. It's fed from Europe Lake. And in 1948, they put a causeway, a roadway, across the marshy northern part of Europe Lake, and they put a culvert pipe under it, and the pond was still fed, but occasionally starved because mattresses were stuffed in and so on and so forth to keep the level of Europe Lake at an artificial height. And then later on, a couple of decades, they paved over and raised the level of the road, because when it was gravel, the water would literally flow through the pipe and over the road with fish swimming on over.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something to see. But anyway, it fed the pond. And the pond has kind of a curious turn to the northern end. It turns to the west, and it certainly floods an area of trees. The species there were just amazing in their diversity, including a badger.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd have least weasels, and you'd have heron, blue heron. You would have sandhill cranes would come and, you know, walk around on the road, mm-hmm. the driveway, and so forth.
So now that's gone, or is it?
It's what has happened over the years is you have just a couple of individuals who continually block up the pipe, and the last time they blocked it was with a load of stone. The first thing they did is the lake end of the pipe, they put an elbow on it so that the water had to, you know, reach another 12 inches up before it flowed in and out. And first time that the DNR was notified about it, they said, take that off. And it was taken off, and the pond, was restored to its usual, depth. And, ducks and amphibians, the night was a wall of sound, of frogs. There must have been 10,000 of them out there.
Well, what do you do in a situation like this? Clearly, this seems to me that somebody's breaking the law there, Aaron.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I've actually spoken to, is this Ralph that's called in? Is that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, Ralph, we've spoken about this issue a number of times over the years, and I'm sorry to hear it's not resolved. I thought we had managed to get them to take care of this. So there's a few things happening here. I mean, obviously, if there's a culvert that's put in with the intention of maintaining connectivity to an adjacent area, in this case a wetland, then that culvert is supposed to be functioning. And in the case of Ralph, he contacted us because he was concerned about the integrity of the wetland, and he had done all the right things in terms of trying to get attention to the matter locally, but they weren't being responsive. And so we were glad that he called us because we were able to make a few phone calls on his behalf and encourage the DNR to look into the matter. And I think between the two of us, we managed to get someone from DNR out to inspect the site and say, yes, actually, this is not supposed to be, this culvert is not supposed to be managed this way. It shouldn't have mattresses or stones stuffed in it to block the outlet. And we've issued a request or maybe even an order to have that corrected. If that isn't being followed, I would just encourage diligence in terms of keeping in touch with the folks at DNR that you've been keeping in touch with. I would consider using the media to call attention to the concerns if there's really a habitat degradation issue. And I would call us again, Ralph, and we'll see what we can do.
All right. Ralph, thank you very much. And Kevin and Aaron, thank you both so much. Just to remind everybody, the annual conference is the January 31st and February 1st coming up for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And you can attend the banquet, hear Kevin's speech, and that's a free of charge event?
No, this is a ticketed event. There's details on our website, wisconsinwetlands.org, for how to purchase a ticket. The banquet is Thursday evening from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m., and there's a dinner and Kevin's talk and a silent auction and lots of other good festive activities.
So go to wisconsinwetlands.org.
Yes.
Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having us. It's been fun.
And Kevin, thank you so much. Appreciate it very much.
Yep, thank you, Larry.
Kevin Zippel is an amphibian ecologist and conservationist and program director for the Amphibian Arc. Aaron O'Brien, wetland policy and conservation specialist with the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Pleased to have them with us. And it'll be an issue that we'll try to keep up on and keep following. This whole business with amphibians. Another issue that's come up that I thought, when we talk about wind energy, it's a clean energy. A lot of people would be in favor of it, and a lot of people are in favor of it, but there are some people who aren't. And the question is why, and what do we do about it? And we'll talk about that with Michael Vickerman. Coming up next, Executive Director of Renew Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.